I believe our time has come, everyone, and I would like to welcome you all to the teleclass, What's New in Immunization? My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, in whose office I happen to be sitting today, I would like to welcome all of you and thank you very much for joining this teleclass. Our faculty today is a very distinguished gentleman, and I'm very pleased that he was able to accommodate us. We did reschedule our teleclass just so we could have him as speaker. Our speaker today is Dr. Raymond Strickus. He is a captain of the U.S. Public Health Service, Associate Director for Adult Immunization in the Immunization Services Division of the National Immunization Program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, that's a heck of a lot to put on a business card, but it means that he knows more about immunization than almost anybody else, and I'm very pleased that he was able to join us. So from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, to present the teleclass, What's New in Immunization, I'm delighted to present Dr. Ray Strickus. Dr. Strickus.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with your group. I noticed as people were signing on, there were a fair number of people discussing discussing issues or coming in from Canada, and I'm pleased that we can talk to you. At the same time, I will acknowledge the information I'm passing on is mostly based on recommendations for vaccine use in the United States, and a lot of that is transferable to Canada, but not all, and I expect if we have time for questions, and I hope we do, you may point out changes or differences that I may not be thoroughly aware of. So if we move past the introductory slide, I'm obliged to tell you that I have no financial interest or conflict with the manufacturers of any vaccines that I'll be talking about in this presentation. I'll talk about the use of a cellular pertussis vaccine in a manner not yet approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And I will discuss some vaccines at the very end, just mention them, that are not currently licensed by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration as well. The next slide is listed as our topics for this presentation. I'll talk a bit about disease incidence and vaccine coverage in the United States, particularly for children. Talk some about influenza vaccine availability and recommendations for the United States this fall. Meningococcal vaccines as recommended in the U.S., a cellular pertussis vaccine for adolescents, and a word about adults, and vaccines that have just been recently licensed, in particular measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, or Proquad vaccine, and some vaccines that may be coming your way in the very near future but aren't here yet. Chart that reads 20th century annual and current morbidity of vaccine-preventable diseases is one we at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta in the U.S. use frequently because I think it's a very compelling message that because largely related to vaccination, diseases that a generation or two ago were very common and felt to be a rite of passage for children and some adults are now a little more than memories, with the exception of pertussis, which lingers, and we'll talk more about that in detail. But with that exception, there were 97% reductions in all these diseases listed here, and essential elimination of paralytic polio from North America some years ago, effectively elimination of rubella, indigenous rubella from the United States, as well as indigenous measles. So this is a remarkable accomplishment that all of you on the phone who do clinical practice and deliver vaccines can take a great deal of credit for, and we're happy to report back to you the good work you're doing as demonstrated by this chart. There are, of course, vaccine-preventable diseases not listed on this chart, such as hepatitis A, hepatitis B, influenza, pneumococcal disease, where we've seen some improvements for some of those, but they're not as striking as this. So there's more work to be done for existing vaccine-preventable diseases, and as I'll talk about, we have new vaccines coming that will make our lives more interesting but more complicated. The next panel discusses diseases that have been eliminated from the United States, and to the ones I mentioned, measles and rubella, we can add, and polio, we can add smallpox, where the last case in the U.S. was in 1949, and fortunately to date we've not seen that disease recur, and we hope we don't see any of these recur in any consequence except perhaps importation of the odd importation of measles, rubella, or polio. The panel, next panel reads 2004 National Immunization Survey, which is a telephone survey conducted by our program on a regular basis to assess vaccination uptake in children, particularly focusing on two-year-old children. Two-year-olds for the purpose of the survey are defined as children 19 months to 35 months of age. And for these vaccines and vaccine series used in the U.S. as described here, we see that coverage is pretty high. except for pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, which has only been around for us since 2000, but coverage is on up to 73% in those 5 years and 5% in the last year. And we are approaching 90% for all the other vaccines. The 43133 series combination of these vaccines is pretty good at 81%, though we'd like more children to be up to date for all their commonly required or recommended vaccines. So why are immunization coverage levels so high in the U.S. and other places that have the opportunity to deliver these vaccines? I think a large part of it is to do with utilization of evidence-based strategies. These were summarized by Briss and colleagues in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine in 2000, and these include, though aren't limited to, assessment of practice coverage with feedback to providers so they know how they're doing with delivery of preventive services, including immunization, reminder recall for patients, including listing folks in immunization registry, prompting of providers, it's another way of saying reminders to providers, be they electronic or chart stickers or the like, and standing orders for programs such as those in long-term care facilities and in clinics and hospitals that can allow, with pre-agreed-upon rules and orders, that nurses and others can give vaccines to patients meeting certain criteria without needing to get an order for the specific patient from the physician. So these things have all made a difference in improving immunization coverage. The first specific topic I'd like to go over is proposed changes for the 2006 child and adolescent immunization schedule that's used in the U.S. now for a number of years. The format, as I'll show you, was similar to that of the 2005 schedule. We will replace the tetanus diphtheria toxoid with tetanus diphtheria cellular pertussis vaccine for 11 to 12 and 13 to 18-year-olds. Meningococcal conjugate vaccine as a routine vaccine has been added for 11 to 12-year-olds. Footnotes describing those changes will be added and some minor wording changes, as well as a modification of tetanus diphtheria toxoid ketchup. So here is the schedule that's currently in use in the U.S. for 2005, and this is a format many of you have seen for a number of years. This schedule is also approved by the American Academy of Pediatrics and American Academy of Family Physicians. So that's the current one. The proposed one, still a draft, not final yet, is this next panel. And you see then the TDAP would be beginning at 11 to 12 years of age and then continuing. We'll talk about that more later, but at this point it's only licensed for one booster dose in an individual, not more than one, but we would like that one to get in there to deal with pertussis. And the other major change is meningococcal conjugate vaccine, or MCV4. Listed and beginning at 11, 12 years of age also and continuing, though an acceptable alternative if it's absent is meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine. Okay, on the next panel, we'll talk, begin a series of points to be made about influenza vaccine use in the United States for this fall and into the winter, 05-06. The supply update that I can offer you is that in the United States, four companies are expected to produce influenza vaccine, and at this point we can say they've all brought vaccine to market or shortly will. Sanofi Pasteur, the largest provider of inactivated influenza vaccine, is projected to produce 60 million doses, most of which should be out by the end of November. The Chiron Corporation has gone through an extensive process of remediation, both with the British regulatory authorities and our Food and Drug Administration, and they just had three lots of their vaccine released by the FDA, which means it can be sold and distributed and sold as soon as they finish some paperwork. So they're producing 18 million and 26 million doses, and we're happy that they're able to provide vaccine for the U.S. again. GlaxoSmithKline was licensed by our FDA August 31st of this year, and they're expected to provide 8 million doses, much of which has been already been distributed. And the MedImmune company produces the live nasal spray vaccine, and they project about 3 million doses of vaccine. In aggregate, if all this vaccine comes out, it's between 89 and 97 million doses, which is more vaccine than the U.S. has ever had distributed. The challenge is, and some may have questions about this, there have been some delays in getting vaccine to market, primarily then that those who ordered Chiron vaccine from a distributor or a vendor haven't yet received any vaccine, and we understand that people are very concerned about that, but there is still ample time to vaccinate before we expect influenza season to begin in full swing. So in part answer to the issue, but when will I get my influenza vaccine, Sanofi Pasteur offered this statement that I will not read the entire statement, but it reads in part that partial shipments have been the rule with Sanofi for some years, and they continue such that all providers who are serving priority patients in the U.S., and I'll define priority patients in a minute, will receive some vaccine, and typically the people are getting between 20% and 40% of their vaccine early on. Unless they have a small order, typically less than 500 doses, they may get all their vaccine all at once. This is a complex chart, but it's just a way of, for you to have as a reference about the types of inactivated influenza vaccine available in the U.S. in 05-06, listing Fluzone, which is Sanofi Pasteur, Fluvirin, Chiron, Fluarix, GSK, and the presentations, how these products are available and for which age groups are the products indicated. Also, for some, it is important to know if the product has thimerosal in it as a preservative. And as you see, the majority of the presentations have no more than a trace of thimerosal, with the exception of Sanofi's multi-dose vial and Chiron's multi-dose vial. But one can find, if one is looking for a product with little or no thimerosal, there are some products available. Albeit, there are still no convincing scientific evidence that thimerosal in vaccines has been linked to any significant health problem. Because of the uncertainty of when vaccine would get to market, and frankly, if the Chiron product would get to market, and this uncertainty persisted, frankly, until lots were released, we chose on September 2nd to issue a recommendation, which is abstracted on the slide, a snapshot of script from our Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which reads on the slide number 15, priority groups for influenza vaccination, listing the eight priority groups. We asked to receive influenza vaccine early on through October 23rd, and that beginning, the slide is a little bit in there. It should say on October 24th and thereafter, vaccinate everyone else, assuming supplies are adequate. But these are the priority groups, the same ones the U.S. used last fall when we had a shortfall of vaccine because Chiron wasn't available. And I will not read them to you. Some of you are probably very familiar with these, but they are the standard priority groups we used a year ago. People at high risk of complications of influenza, older people at high risk conditions for complications, pregnant women, healthcare personnel, and household contacts and caregivers of children less than 6 months of age, because those very young children can't receive influenza vaccine, and those very young children are at very high risk of hospitalization related to influenza, so we think it's important to protect the people around them since we can't directly protect those children. The next panel just offers an amplification of the definition of comorbid condition. Generally, an underlying condition increases your risk of complications, and a smattering of organ systems are listed there, lung, heart, kidney. Diabetes immunosuppression covers most, but perhaps not all, the conditions. One new one our advisory committee added this year is persons who have any condition that leads to compromise of handling respiratory secretions, such as neuromuscular conditions, stroke, seizure disorders, and the like, would also be added to this group of people with comorbid conditions of significance. In the United States, there's a program called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that if someone feels they have had a problem, medical problem arising after vaccination, they can petition to this government program for compensation of their injury. Influenza vaccine has been added to that program as of July 1st of 2005, and the criteria for that are because it is now routinely recommended for children of one age or another, in this case, routinely recommended for children 6 months to 23 months of age. And so what that means is all influenza vaccines are covered. One could retroactively go back 8 years before July 1st, 05, if when you felt you had an injury and petition for redress and compensation. Anyone receiving influenza vaccine may receive, may petition for compensation, and details are at the website that is there. The other thing that is probably the most routine thing that affects folks giving vaccines in the United States is for all vaccines in this program, one is obliged to take our vaccine injury statement, vaccine information statement that's available at cdc.gov/NIP and look for vaccine information statements and give that statement to the vaccine recipient or his or her legal guardian or parent. And they must be given that once we have a final vaccine information statement. For influenza, we have an interim one. You're not required to use the interim one, though we strongly encourage you to do that. But we do, once the final one is out, we think in the next month or so, you're required to start using the final one and give it to, the patient or their parent or legal guardian. A few words about live attenuated influenza vaccine indications. I'll remind you the vaccine is licensed for people 5 to 49 years of age who are healthy and not pregnant. So this would include, in those priority groups I mentioned, close contacts of persons at high risk, including healthcare workers and children less than 6 months of age. But also, there is no prioritization or recommendation restriction of use of this vaccine because we feel it's an ample supply for the number of people who wanted it in the past. So in the U.S., anyone who wants to use the live vaccine may certainly do so, whether they meet the priority groupings or not, and they meet, provided they meet the eligibility criteria for the vaccine listed here. I should remind you that as of this year, the live vaccine need not be stored in a freeze box that the manufacturer provided, which was done in an effort to assure maintenance of frozen temperature. In this case, if you have a regular frost-free freezer, you may keep the vaccine there without a special freeze box, which used to limit the amount of space, amount of vaccine you could store, and it took up about a half to two-thirds of people's average freezers. It was a large nuisance. And the vaccine also now can be stored up to 60 hours at refrigerator temperature after you've thawed it, but after that you must discard it if you haven't used it. So one could thaw vaccine overnight and then keep it for a day or two in hopes of using it, and so it's a little more flexible that way. The ultimate answer to the problem here is to have a refrigerator-stable vaccine, and there is expectation or hope that the company will license one by fall of 07, but that's not happened yet. Now let's turn away from influenza, talk a bit about meningococcal disease. These are data on this graph from 1972 through 2004. The white line shows the ebbs and flows of meningococcal disease cases in the U.S. The U.S. average is about 2,700 cases in the red line, and there's been a downswing. And reasons for that are not entirely clear. It's not probably due to increased vaccination. We'll notice that 30 years ago there was a downswing in meningococcal disease as well. So there is a periodicity to this disease. It's not well explained, though we hope use of vaccine may help keeping the disease incidence down. And this next panel shows meningococcal disease, slide 21, incidence by age group in 1998. And this hasn't really changed very much since then, in that the highest incidence is in children less than 1 year of age, next highest children 1 to 4. And then there's a little peak, you see, if children 15 to 24 years of age. And that's important when we think about the recommendations for vaccination. So again, highest rate on the next panel, children less than 1 year of age. About half the cases occur, though, in people 15 years of age or older. And a strategy of infant immunization would not affect disease for a number of years. Therefore, and a little more investigation on the next panel about disease among young adults, and a study CDC did in 1998-99 looked at the question of, indeed, who in young adults is at increased risk for meningococcal disease. And if you take all persons 18 to 23 years of age, their incidence is 1.4 per 100,000, barely above the U.S. average of 1 per 100,000. Interestingly, though, if one becomes a freshman in a college dormitory, the rate rises to 5.1 per 100,000. And this is not perhaps surprising to those who follow this disease because it's not that different than what was evidenced by people in military barracks, military recruits of the same age years ago, which is why the military for years has been vaccinating people against meningococcal disease, although student dormitories may not always be as crowded as barracks, sometimes more so. But there is an increased risk. So as a result, thought was given to offering vaccine to those individuals. One limitation, though, one has to remember is both the old vaccine in the U.S., the polysaccharide vaccine, and the current conjugate vaccine include four serotypes, but they don't include type B. And therefore, we see on this panel, meningococcal disease in the U.S., the distribution of cases by serogroup, that 31% of the cases through 2001 in a five-year period were serogroup B, and that more than half of the cases, nearly two-thirds in children less than 1 year of age, were due to serogroup B. So the current vaccine is a good product, but it's not going to cover, by definition, serogroup B, which causes a lot of disease, particularly in infants, and that's a challenge, and it's a difficult a serogroup to make a vaccine for. No one's got a very effective one as yet. This is some information about the polysaccharide vaccine made by Sanofi Pasteur, serogroups ACY-W135. It is presently approved in the U.S. for children 2 years of age and older and adults. One dose with some selective revaccination. Note this is given subcutaneously, which is in contrast to the new vaccine, which is given intramuscularly. One sees an age-related immune response. It's not so great in young children, particularly those less than 2 years of age. With polysaccharide vaccines, we generally don't see a booster response. We just hope to see antibody rise to about where it was with the first vaccination. And the antibody tends to have less functional activity. It doesn't stimulate T cells, so it's got some limitations. The conjugate vaccine, also by Sanofi, called Manactra, has got the same four serogroups. These are now conjugated to a diphtheria protein toxoid. It's approved a more restricted age grouping, 11 to 55 years of age. Again, a one-dose schedule. There's no revaccination recommendation as yet, and again, an intramuscular product, so the different way to administer the vaccine. So if you want to vaccinate, on the next slide, now slide 28, persons either 2 through 10 years of age or those 55 or older, over 55, they should receive the polysaccharide vaccine because the conjugate vaccine is not licensed for this population. So the recommendations on slide 29 that our advisory committee on immunization practices issued this past May include military recruits would routinely be felt to be at high risk and receive the vaccine. There are certain research and laboratory personnel should be vaccinated. Travelers and U.S. citizens residing in countries where Neisseria meningitidis is endemic. Those with complement deficiencies, people with HIV infection, and people with anatomic asplenia or functional asplenia should all be considered high risk and should receive this vaccine. In addition, the new recommendations in the U.S. are the ones here on slide 30, now recommended routinely to use the conjugate vaccine for all persons, children at the pre-adolescent visit defined as ages 11 to 12 years, those about to enter high school age 15 years, and college freshmen who are living in a dormitory. And other adolescents who wish to reduce risk of meningococcal disease may receive the vaccine if they wish to. So a substantial change in recommendations. There are a number of colleges and states in the United States that required meningococcal vaccination over the last few years, and this will probably just continue. And this acknowledges the ACIP recommendations on slide 31. That colleges may wish to require that because of the nature and the severity of the disease. Now, regarding revaccination with meningococcal vaccine, this may be indicated for people at very high risk of infection, and this doesn't include college settings. I mean, there may be increased risk there, but we don't think it's terribly high risk. This has more to do with persons living in the Middle East and other parts of the world where meningitis is much more common. Revaccination will be considered for children if they were in such circumstances. If they were first vaccinated when they were less than 4 years of age, within 2 to 3 years. For other persons, you might go 5 years before revaccination, as discussed here. If one's going to revaccinate someone who received the polysaccharide vaccine and they're 11 to 55 years of age, the conjugate vaccine is preferable because it's felt to offer longer protection, though data are still being collected on that. Whether one needs to do revaccination after receiving a conjugate vaccine is being collected. We don't know. If one continues to live in a closed setting, a college dormitory or even military barracks, there's no present indication to revaccinate those individuals. The risk, for whatever reason, seemed to be crowded around people newly entering those types of facilities. There's an issue then, as I mentioned, that if one gave the conjugate vaccine, this is discussed on slide 34, by the subcutaneous route, what does one do? Because it's an intramuscular vaccine, there are no data on the effectiveness of this vaccine given sub-Q, and Sanofi Pasteur recommends you repeat the dose. If it was given sub-Q, give it intramuscularly, and we're trying to get some data to guide this recommendation, which is made on opinion. We need some data to guide it better. In the U.S., there's been a lot of demand for this vaccine, given the increased attention to meningococcal disease in adolescents and college students. And CDC just recommends that providers try to limit vaccinations to groups at increased risk until supply catches up with demand. Most recently, there was a report by CDC and the Food and Drug Administration last week that the conjugate vaccine, Manactra, has been associated with 5 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome in 17, 18-year-old persons in the U.S., all who receive Manactra within 4 weeks of the onset of their Guillain-Barré syndrome. At this point, because it's not clear, there's an increased rate of Guillain-Barré syndrome among vaccine recipients as compared to non-vaccine recipients, those who did not receive vaccine. There's no change in the vaccine recommendations. We are looking to see if there are more cases to be reported to try to get a better handle on this. And so, as with any adverse event that is of severe nature as this one, there is concern, but again, no clear association. It is, at this point, a temporal association that needs further investigation. So let me move now to pertussis in the U.S., and here's a graphic showing the striking increase in the number of cases, and as you'll see, incidence as well in the U.S. since about the late 1990s, though it's actually been going up since 1980, slowly and more strikingly recently, and the reasons for this are not entirely clear. We do know on slide 38 that we have high levels of pertussis vaccination in two-year-old children based on our survey, the National Immunization Survey, but at the same time we've seen over 25,000 cases reported in the U.S., and this is more than any time since 1959. So we look at slide 39, where there's a graphic breaking down reported cases by different age groups. We see that the number of cases has gone up a lot in all the age groups, in these three here stratified, less than 11 years, 11, 18, and 19 years and older. So there are increases in all groups. The incidence rate, another way to look at it, of adolescents and adults increased by 60% in 2003. About a third of reported pertussis cases were in persons 10 to 19 years of age, and there are 8,000 reported cases in this age group in 2004. So a lot of pertussis relative to previous numbers before. So given we've recently had, and I'll talk about vaccines in a moment, two vaccines licensed that could be used for adolescents, one can be used in adults, the objectives thought about are to try to protect vaccinated adolescents against pertussis and secondarily reduce the reservoir of Bordetella pertussis in the population and perhaps reduce incidence of pertussis in other age groups, particularly young children who are at highest risk of complications. I'll remind you, though those of you who see patients in the clinical setting who know this better than I, pertussis can be a severe illness in adolescents and adults, typically presents itself with a prolonged cough, sometimes more than 3 months. One can see loss of sleep, post-tussive vomiting, loss of consciousness, and weight loss. It becomes nearly a chronic illness. And up to 2% of adolescents will develop pneumonia. Some have severe coughing and lead to rib fractures. Up to 1% are hospitalized. And as with any severe illness, there's medical costs, miss school and work, and a significant impact on public health. So the vaccines we're talking about, beginning on slide 44, for tetanus, diphtheria, cellular pertussis vaccines. GlaxoSmithKline licensed Boostrix on May 3rd in the U.S., approved as a single booster dose for persons 10 to 18 years of age. That is in persons who've completed 4 to 5 doses of a vaccine for children, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, whole cell, or diphtheria, tetanus, cellular pertussis licensed for use in children. Adacel is a Sanofi product licensed in June, a single booster dose, a broader age indication, 11 to 64 years, again for persons who've had a primary series of diphtheria, tetanus, and some sort of pertussis vaccine. This is a graphic called Composition of New TDAP Vaccine, slide 46. The first four items on the far left-hand column are pertussis antigens. And the point here is just to indicate comparison levels of antigen or toxoid in the DTaP vaccines used in children in the U.S. as compared to the new drugs, vaccines Adacel and Boostrix. And the point is that one's using substantially less, usually, of pertussis toxins in the vaccine either vaccine used for adolescents or adults, and also on the lower end of range for diphtheria toxoid and tetanus toxoid. So the point being, if one used the higher levels, and that's why we don't recommend you use the childhood vaccines in adults, one could see significant local reactions. One doesn't need that level of antigen in the adult or adolescent vaccines. At this point, there's no preference for one brand over another, provided you're using the appropriate one for the age group. Either one can be used for adolescents, but only Adacel could be used for adults. We think TDAP is preferred to tetanus diphtheria toxoid to offer additional protection against pertussis. At this point, one can only give a single dose to an individual in their lifetime. We like to think that will change. And again, in TDAP, neither of these vaccines is approved to children less than 10 years of age. So the recommendations from our advisory committee for adolescents are that adolescents 11 to 12 years of age should receive a single dose of tetanus diphtheria cellular pertussis vaccine, not tetanus diphtheria toxoid. And if their adolescents 13 to 18 years of age have not received one of the new vaccines, they should receive TDAP instead of tetanus diphtheria toxoid as a booster for tetanus diphtheria and offer, again, the additional protection against pertussis. Our advisory committee encourages that adolescents who received a tetanus diphtheria toxoid booster, they should also receive a tetanus diphtheria cider pertussis vaccine to protect them against pertussis. And ideally, it'd be a five-year interval between the two, the concern being, as you may know, too often a delivery of tetanus toxoid in particular, and perhaps diphtheria as well, can lead to significant local reactions, commonly called artuse reactions, delayed hypersensitivity type of reaction, or severe local reactions. If one's very concerned about pertussis in the community, you could use a shorter interval between TD and TDAP. There's not an absolute minimum interval identified by our advisory committee or our expert consultants. So the provider has to decide in the setting whether one wants to do this or not, risking a small chance of adverse event versus the risk of pertussis for the individual. There's not a lot of these vaccines out there yet, and so providers may want to defer a dose of TD until they get TDAP if there's not much pertussis in their community. And this is reasonable if person's not had a dose of tetanus within the last 10 years, doesn't need any immediate protection from tetanus, and the person is expected to return for a visit when the TDAP is available. Well, one doesn't really want to lose an opportunity to protect against tetanus as well as pertussis. So again, it's a judgment call as to when you'll receive the new vaccine and whether the child would come back if, in the case of an adolescent. As with all vaccines, there should be documentation of having received whichever vaccine they're getting. If there's no documentation that the child or adolescents received a series of diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccines, then one should begin a series of three vaccinations, and the recommendation would be a single dose of TDAP, with the second dose being just tetanus diphtheria toxoid 4 weeks later, and then the third dose in the series, the second TD, 6 months after the second dose. Now, this is not a recommendation for our Food and Drug Administration. This is expert opinion from our advisory committee. The contraindications and precautions for TDAP are different than those for TD or childhood diphtheria, tetanus, cider, pertussis. This is slide 53, and it does say C handout. There is no handout besides the slides you've received, and I'll summarize what was in the handout for this presentation originally on the next few panels. The contraindications are severe allergic reaction to a vaccine component or following a prior dose. This is common to all vaccines. For pertussis vaccines, there is a specific contraindication, and there is one for this product, either Adacel or Boostrix, that encephalopathy within 7 days of a pertussis vaccine that is not attributable to another cause is a contraindication to any further pertussis vaccination. If there's a history of an artuse-type reaction following previous dose of tetanus or diphtheria containing toxoid, you wouldn't give another dose. If one had progressive neurological disorder, uncontrolled epilepsy, or progressive encephalopathy, you would not vaccinate until the neurologic disorder was diagnosed and under control. If there's a severe, that is anaphylactic latex allergy, because there are latex particles in the rubber stoppers for these vaccines. If a person had Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks after prior dose of tetanus toxoid, that's a contraindication. And at the time of vaccination, if someone presents with moderate or severe illness in the judgment of the practitioner, you would defer vaccination until that illness had resolved or was improving. Some things that are not contraindications or precautions for tetanus diphtheria, acellular pertussis vaccine, or high fever, collapse or shock-like stake in the past. This is following previous pertussis vaccination, persistent crying, convulsions, or a limb swelling reaction. These are things that do sometimes happen with these vaccines, but they're not contraindications or precautions for subsequent vaccination. And nor are things such as stable neurologic disorder, pregnancy, breastfeeding, immunosuppression, minor illnesses, or current antibiotic use. These are not reasons to avoid tetanus diphtheria, cider, pertussis vaccine. The next panel is just a sample of the vaccine information statement that you can download from our website and you should be using with this vaccine, which is also part of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And slide 59. Comments on what can we say about giving tetanus diphtheria cider pertussis vaccine to persons 19 years of age or older, and the short answer is that our advisory committee is developing recommendations. They are not in existence as yet. So we're thinking about what those might be and thinking about, in particular, should there be specific vaccination recommendations for healthcare workers to avoid their increase, diminishing, to try to diminish their risk of pertussis in the workplace, to try to avoid precipitating outbreaks in the healthcare workplace. In addition, should one be vaccinating parents of young children, infants, and pregnant women, try to avoid the serious problem of pertussis in infancy, since you can't vaccinate or properly protect infants till they're 6 months of age with three doses of childhood pertussis vaccines. So these are some of the considerations that are going on in the U.S. And at this point, we do know that, of course, providers can use Adacel for persons 11 to 64 years of age, according to labeling, but only as a single dose in someone who's completed a series previously of diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines. So a few words in closing about vaccines that may be on your horizon. There are a variety of new combinations that may come up, and I won't recite them all. And in Canada, you're using a number of combinations we don't use in the U.S. You know more about it than I do. There is a new rotavirus vaccine, not RotaShield. The Merck company may have a product out soon. I'll talk a bit about herpes zoster or shingles vaccine. Human papillomavirus vaccine is being developed by Merck and GlaxoSmithKline, and they have a license applications that will probably go in pretty soon. And there is work being done for herpes simplex virus in particular, to some extent on gonococcal disease, two sexually transmitted diseases, and vaccines may appear for those soon. As I mentioned early on, just licensed in September in the United States, measles, mumps, rubella, varicella vaccine, or ProQuad from Merck, was approved by our Food and Drug Administration for children 12 months to 12 years of age, that is under 13. This has to be a frozen vaccine, as you do with varicella vaccine, and this may facilitate a recommendation for a routine second dose of varicella vaccine that our advisory committee debated but did not choose to adopt in this past June. One should know that this vaccine is not just simply throwing together MMR and varicella. The titer varicella vaccine virus in the MMRV is more than 15 times higher than the standard Merck product Varivax. The reason for that is because there's some competition when you mix these together. They're all live viruses to allow it to replicate properly in the host once they're vaccinated and get immunity, because it is competing with measles, mumps, rubella viruses. So as Dr. Atkinson, who was kind enough to supply me these slides, wrote here, don't try to mix up your own MMRV, please. It's not a good idea. If you're going to do this, you should buy Merck's product, or if you don't have it, use just MMR and varicella separately. They can be given at the same time in separate injections. The herpes zoster vaccine, or if you will, shingles vaccine, the supposed trade name is going to be Zostavax, was studied in an extensive trial that I'll talk about very briefly. And this is a vaccine that would be administered to persons, adults of a certain age to be determined, who had chickenpox in the past to reduce the risk of subsequent development of zoster. This has a much higher titer of varicella virus than does a standard Varivax, and it's yet to be determined what it'll be, but probably in the order of 18-fold higher titer, something like that. And there was a trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine on June 2, 2005, and I recommend it to you as a wonderful example of how a trial should be done, and involving many, many investigators. It's a remarkable paper. And Merck has filed a biologic license application in the United States for this product. The brief summary of the paper in the New England Journal by Oxman et al., and the reference is at the bottom of slide 64, is that about 36,700 persons 60 years of age and older were followed for an average of 3 years after vaccination. Compared to the placebo group, the vaccinated group had about half, a little better than half, fewer episodes of herpes zoster. Their illnesses were less severe, and about two-thirds less frequency of postherpetic neuralgia. And there were no significant problems with the safety of the vaccine identified, which is a abbreviation of a large, complex trial. And again, I commend it to you. Last panel, slide 65. That's a lot of information I've gone over in the last 40 minutes or so. You have the slides. If you don't get a chance to ask me a question or think of a question later on, you can email me at rstrikas, R-S-T-R-I-K-A-S, at cdc.gov. If you forget that, many of my colleagues man our general email inbox, which is the nipinfo@cdc.gov on slide 65. Mailbox. You can also call the CDC hotline, which is listed there, 800-CDC-INFO. There's a wealth of information about vaccine issues as they pertain to the work we do here at cdc.gov/NIP. And then there's also a sub-site there on vaccine safety that is listed. So that concludes my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to take questions now, or again, you may email me later on.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Strickas. I was hoping to get out of this teleclass a look into the future of vaccination. I think in your final slides, we certainly did receive that. Very, very thorough and complete. Thank you very much. I will echo some of Dr. Strickas's opening comments and mention just for the record that teleclass education does not endorse or advertise any company or product. Many of you have heard me say that many times, but it bears saying again.
For the kind doctor, I just wondered if he had any hypothesis why there is a reported increase in pertussis.
I don't know. I think, and I didn't say this, I think some of the considerations are that we'd like to believe that surveillance is much better for pertussis, that practitioners are better able to pick it up, they think of it more, they test more for it, and whether there's truly an increased incidence, we believe there is some of that, but we think some of it may be surveillance artifact, but nevertheless, one deals with increased numbers. Another thing that's been raised, and I think there are no data to support this, is that indeed is acellular pertussis vaccine as good at protecting people against pertussis as is the the whole cell vaccine was. I don't think that's clearly supported anywhere because the increased incidences are particularly prominent in adolescents and in adults where one can talk about waning immunity. And so perhaps the degree to which acellular pertussis vaccine could be thought of, and this is hypothetical, no confirmation, is that perhaps the whole cell vaccine was better at having immunity last a bit longer into adolescence and adulthood, though we did know it was not permanent either. So that may be a piece of it. We're not sure. I mean, the bottom line is we don't exactly know why there's reported more pertussis in the U.S., but it's there.
I'd like to thank you all for joining this teleclass today, and a special thanks to Dr. Strickas for sharing his time and his talent with us. Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.